Today, the devastation of Cyclone Idai, one of the worst weather-related disasters to ever hit the Southern Hemisphere. And Sonia Soda on what on earth is going on in Parliament.
The people who were perhaps in the worst situation were the people who were stuck in the trees, because it wasn't just people who got driven up into the trees by the water, but snakes as well, and people getting bitten while they're up in the trees.
Oh my God, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Kind of imagine that choice of being in a tree and being in a tree above water and not knowing when the water's going to go away and not knowing how long you can sit in the tree for and having to share that space with snakes.
2 weeks ago, Cyclone Idai hit Mozambique, one of the poorest countries in the world. It caused catastrophic damage, obliterating most of the city of Beira, killing hundreds and destroying the homes of thousands of others. And then the floods came. The fallout from the tropical storm has affected almost 2 million lives, not just in Mozambique, but also Malawi and Zimbabwe. Questions are being asked about why the government did not do more to protect the opposition city of Beira. And now the first cases of the waterborne disease, cholera, are complicating an already massive and complex emergency. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the devastation of Cyclone Idai, one of the worst weather disasters to ever hit the Southern Hemisphere. Last Wednesday, Peter Beaumont, a senior reporter at The Guardian, reached the city of Beira on the coast of Mozambique just days after Cyclone Idai had devastated the region.
As soon as you arrive, you're aware that you're at the centre of a big emergency response effort. There is a bustle of kind of aid workers. The operation centre is right next to the arrivals hall. I got there about 11 o'clock at night and sort of, at that stage, I mean, in the dark, you're aware of all these fallen trees on all the roads. No lights at all, no people, and bits of standing water, glass, bits of asbestos off the roof, corrugated iron, sort of all coming out of the dark at you.
Can you describe Beira for me?
Beira's a small city on the coast. It's run down. It could have seen better days. It's an opposition city, so it hasn't really seen a lot of love from the government. There are a few old sort of Portuguese colonial buildings, and it had a lot of trees. So, you know, at one stage, you kind of think if you'd been there before the storm, it would have had a certain charm from all the trees. Now, of course, a lot of the poorer neighbourhoods have been very, very heavily hit. I mean, you drive through them and you see people in houses that are still standing, but, you know, maybe in 100 metres of muddy water, trying to live above the standing water. It was probably 90% damaged, but not destroyed. The real catastrophe had taken place outside the city.
Did people know the cyclone was coming?
Cyclones are common in this part of the world. I mean, it's the Indian Ocean. It's a big, swirling depression of winds and rain. They'd planned for a fairly major event. I mean, what actually happened in this case? This very slow-moving storm hits the coast by Beira, and then it kind of doubles back and it hits again. So the storm makes landfall twice. And as it's grinding over the coast, it's putting down absolutely phenomenal amounts of water. So when this happened on the Thursday night, people emerged from this thinking, I'm still here. OK, it's done. We're going to start tidying up. The double tap, as it were, that happened was the water that had fallen on the higher ground over the Zimbabwe and the Zimbabwean border. The ground slopes down from the border all the way to this area, which is the lowest lying ground in Mozambique. The dams topped out from the sheer amount of rainfall and then poured down into this low, flat area.
We are stuck in Mount Selinda, as we try to navigate to Mozambique through the Mount Selinda border. The rivers are swelling with water.
The rivers burst their bank, particularly the Buzi and Pungwe rivers, which kind of come across this region. And really quite quickly, the water began to rise. I mean, I spoke to people who said that by the Saturday evening, having survived the winds, that they were getting flooded out. And for a lot of people, it was that period between the Saturday night and the Sunday when the waters rose very quickly. And if you were lucky, you were close enough to high ground and the waters were coming slowly enough, if you were lucky, for you to get up into a tree or onto a rooftop or onto somewhere that was slightly more elevated that turned into an island. If, for instance, you were on the wrong side of the river in the town of Buzi, which got very heavily destroyed, there was nowhere to go. You're just in the flat bit. There are trees, maybe. There are no substantial old buildings to get on top of. And the question is, what happened to those people?
We were in our house and then we heard the mountain exploding. The water started flowing through the streets and we had to run away.
There is hunger here. Houses were washed away. We don't have a place to stay. All our food stocks were damaged and children died. We are suffering.
There have been devastating accounts about the damage. I mean, stories of villages being swept away. Could you, while you were there on the ground, get a sense of the scale of the damage?
It was only really when I flew out at the end of the trip that I really got a sense of just how powerful this event was. I mean, even from, you know, several thousand feet up in the air, you could see one of the rivers that you flew over on the way south. You could see at the river mouth standing waves, both going across the river mouth and kind of along the spine of it. And you can just imagine the kind of force of the currents and the undertow that's in that water that's still pouring down through the river. This was a very, very large event. I mean, in terms of the impact, it might well be one of the biggest kind of disasters of this kind to hit the Southern Hemisphere.
This situation is very, very serious. It's a trouble. Yeah, I can say that we are in trouble. Yeah, it's a dangerous situation because the people are dying.
In terms of the death toll, the census data before this wasn't terribly good. It was a heavily populated rural area. I've spoken to people who did see bodies in the water. But I mean, it's still not clear how many lives were lost. I mean, one thing you can say with absolute certainty is this couldn't have happened at a worse time for an area like this. I mean, most of the people in the countryside are subsistence farmers. This was harvest time. They've lost their crops. So this is going to have a very long tail for people who'd already suffered a number of years of drought in southern Africa. You know, it was a big deal.
It was actually in the evening when we arrived, and it was absolutely devastated. I mean, there were trees across the road.
Must be incredibly challenging for the people working within the rescue effort too. You spoke to Travis Trower, who's from Rescue South Africa. What did he tell you?
Well, Travis Trower said that when they were initially coming in, that they could see people sheltering in the trees not far from the road. And, you know, they managed to get close enough that people were able to throw the babies down.
We couldn't rescue all of them. They were handing their babies out of trees to us into boats that were paddling into the shore. So that was the first phase.
He said, you know, eventually the waters were rising too fast and it was too strong and they had to go away, you know, because I believe it was nighttime, and they thought, oh, we'll go back. And you know, he said when they went back again, the village, the place that they'd seen had just gone.
Even when you fly in the air, it's as far as you can see, it's just water. Now, I haven't seen a house that doesn't have some sort of roof damage or roof missing off it. No, it's incredible to see it.
I spoke to some of the Indian Navy boat crews who were doing rescues over in Buzi, and you know, they found they would be mobbed when they were going in to try and help people out. From their point of view, they couldn't take everyone. I mean, there wasn't enough capacity.
Travelling around the region must have been really difficult. I mean, how did you leave Beira and get to some of the rural communities?
We'd been told that if we drove for about 45, 50 kilometres along the main highway, we would eventually hit where the flooding started. The thing that was really striking was that the further and further you went up this road, on either side, as far as the eye could see, was water. You could just see the treetops coming out of the water eventually, with this ribbon of elevated roads going right up to where it had been washed out. And eventually we got to this cluster of roadside huts that had been knocked down by the floodwaters. And everyone was just living on the hard shoulder. They'd got bits of plastic sheeting, a tiny bit of corrugated iron from a roof. And they'd made these little shelters by the road. And they told us they'd seen no help at all at that stage. I mean, you know, as soon as you got outside of the main effort, often that was the story. It was just too early for a lot of the aid to reach people in more isolated places. They'd heard the helicopters flying over, you know, either to do the rescues of people from trees or, you know, to drop food onto the little islands where people had sheltered. And, you know, people quite rightly wanted to know a week afterwards why they had no help.
The flooding happened a week ago, and this is the first help we have had, just biscuits. We are struggling to survive because everything was destroyed.
I've thought at that stage that, you know, that was pretty shocking. But it was actually only at the end of my reporting trip when I found some people inside the city themselves who'd been flooded out by the seawater surge from a kind of a poor area called Zona Bay, which is on the North Beach. This is right in the centre. This is like 25 minutes drive from the centre of the aid effort. And, you know, these families' kids were eating these tiny fish that had been washed in from the sea and stranded in puddles. And one of the women I interviewed just said, look, this is all we've got, you know. I mean, dead or alive, this is what we're eating. And, you know, unsurprisingly, her children had come down with diarrhoea.
You said that people were angry and upset. Were there mistakes made in the rescue effort?
I think there were mistakes made in the rescue effort. I mean, not particularly anyone's great fault, but I mean, I remember chatting to one of the, you know, the Red Cross officials, and I think when people first looked at it, they looked at the city and they thought, wow, this is what's been hit, and they looked at sort of aerial images and they thought, this is the worst of it. This is what we have to respond to. And so I think everyone tooled up for assisting the city. And then they hadn't predicted what the effect of the water coming down, particularly from Zimbabwe, would be. And I think people were a bit wrong-footed by that. Because of that, there was a sort of a bottleneck over getting the kind of helicopters in they needed, which was search and rescue helicopters and rescue boats. If there was a fault, it was just that they saw what they were expecting and didn't anticipate what they weren't expecting.
How long did it take for the helicopters to get there?
The helicopters really don't start arriving in any significant numbers, you know, for 4 or 5 days. And then you start seeing, you know, these big Russian-built MI-8s coming in that can both drop food and rescue people and have got quite a lot of capacity. I mean, you wonder if that could have been a little bit quicker and whether that would have made it less challenging for many of the people affected.
Were the poorest people impacted most greatly by this?
Yeah, I mean, like most natural disasters, this is one that's hit the poorest people. I mean, one of the things that I think I will always remember about this is just how few people had their shoes, particularly when they're being evacuated by boat from places like Buzi to Beira. I mean, they lost their shoes. They lost all their clothes. I mean, they were just, you know, a lot of people coming out with the clothes they were standing in.
Peter, you've said this is an opposition area. We know the government has been taking action, but there are real frustrations.
Until now, we've had nothing from government. Okay, they gave us 500 kilograms of porridge, but for 2,000 people, it's not enough.
What needs to happen now?
It's going to need an awful lot of assistance. I mean, I think in the short term, there's obviously going to have to be an awful lot of thought about how you support the people who've lost their livelihoods in the rural areas. But I think there's also going to have to be sort of a more wider regional thought about, How do you prevent this happening again? Are the rivers dredged enough? You know, are the dams in Zimbabwe safe enough? Are they big enough? Is there some way of making sure that when you have dams that are threatened with being topped out in this kind of rainfall, which might happen again, whether there are ways of relieving the pressure so the rivers downstream just don't flood out in places like this, which are clearly incredibly vulnerable?
Is there a feeling that this is the result of climate change?
What I think we can say is that we know that as the climate changes, we're going to see more and more kind of these kind of extreme events. And this was a big one, you know, in these kind of climate related disasters. There is probably a contributory factor from climate change. I think that's probably without doubt.
Climate scientists have been warning the world for decades that man-made climate change would do two things. It would mean that hurricanes and cyclones would become more and more intense, and that therefore some of the people with the world's smallest carbon footprints would pay the heaviest price. Right now, you can see that all across this region.
And has deforestation contributed to this?
I think deforestation probably has. I mean, this coastal plain would once upon a time been covered in trees. You know, it's always the case where you've had kind of, you know, forests recently taken down and kind of, you know, it causes problems with the soil stability. I mean, you would have to guess that the amount of deforestation had an impact in the way that this flood spread.
Do you feel that this has been underreported?
I think part of the problem was that to begin with, people didn't appreciate what had happened. And so in terms of both the response by the aid agencies and by the world's media, there was a lag. People hadn't quite appreciated what had happened. But it does feel as though the West was obsessing more about its own problems, whether it's Brexit or the Mueller report, while, you know, a large area of the global south was sitting under a huge amount of water and people were desperately clinging on to survive in treetops. I mean, you know, it did feel as though it kind of challenged some part of Western introspection.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Beaumont has done some amazing reporting from Mozambique for The Guardian. Do read it on the website. Coming up, when MPs reject every form of Brexit and no Brexit, what the hell is going on? Welcome back. Now, Sonia Soda, The Observer's chief leader writer and Guardian deputy comment editor, has been following the unfolding Brexit crisis. Today, Theresa May will try once more to get her deal through, but this time she will ask MPs to vote on just the withdrawal agreement, the divorce if you like, and not the political declaration, which will outline our future trading relationship with the EU. This comes after two massive losses for the Prime Minister and MPs rejecting no deal, but also every other type of deal. Are you following me? Or are you confused? If so, you are not alone. Here is Sonia's point-by-point guide so you can understand what is actually going on.
So it's March the 29th. Britain was supposed to be leaving the European Union at 11 o'clock tonight. But of course, it's no longer Brexit Day. And really, there isn't any more clarity this morning on exactly what's going to happen next. Parliament is currently in a process of holding indicative votes. They had the first round on Wednesday night, and what that told us was that there isn't a majority in favour of anything. And if her deal still hasn't got through next Monday, MPs will be voting again on a series of options. And now all eyes are focused on the new cliff edge, which is April the 12th. So by the time it gets to April the 12th, logically, there are only four options for what's going to happen next. So one is that we crash out without a deal. The second is that Theresa May has somehow managed to get her deal through and we've got a short extension from the EU just to make sure we can get all that legislation passed. The third is we're about to crash out and MPs don't want that to happen. So they take the sort of nuclear option of voting to revoke Article 50 And then who knows what happens from there? Maybe the clock just starts again and we start the whole process again. And lastly, and I think this is what's most likely, actually, we may be in the position where we've requested a long extension from the EU and we've agreed to take part in EU elections. And I think that long extension could come as a result of two things. So either May hasn't got her deal through, but it appears that there is a parliamentary consensus in favour of some sort of softer Brexit, but it's going to take a bit longer to negotiate, or potentially that May's deal perhaps gets through, but only on the basis that she puts it to a referendum. And again, the EU would definitely grant us, I think, a longer extension in that case. So I think a long extension is probably the most likely outcome, but who knows why we'll be there. So what Theresa May said to her party on Wednesday night was that if, and only if, her deal gets through, she would stand down. How likely is she to stand down? Well, I think if her deal gets through somehow, it's not looking massively likely. I think people will be taken aback if it gets through in the next week or so. But I think if it does get through, it will be partly because she's made that pledge to her MPs. Some MPs have now said they will support her deal only because she's said she would step down if it gets through. So I think if she gets her deal through, she will end up resigning. Probably she will go sometime after May the 22nd. Maybe she'll stay on to be a caretaker while the Conservatives conduct a leadership campaign. It's much less clear what would happen if her deal doesn't go through. She could still end up having to resign. There's no official way for MPs in her party to force her out because they mounted a challenge just a few months ago and she's now officially safe under Conservative Party rules until December this year. But there are other ways that people could put pressure on her to leave. Or she may simply decide, if she can't get her deal through, that she can't really carry on with being Prime Minister and stand down. But there's a lot more uncertainty, I think, if her deal doesn't go through in the next week or so. It seems like another week goes by, we get closer to a cliff edge, things feel higher stakes than ever, and yet, it, you know, Parliament doesn't ever kind of really come through. There's a lot of false starts. One example of that is we know there's no majority in Parliament for no deal. MPs have voted against that. They've made that sentiment very clear. But they repeatedly seem to refuse to take the action that would take no deal off the table. So it does feel quite exasperating, and it also feels really worrying. Even as somebody who kind of follows every twist and turn of this, and you know, it is easy to get quite swept up in it, but then you take a step back and you realise just how much is at stake. I do think that no deal is a possibility. I think that even though Parliament doesn't want us to, it's entirely conceivable that we could end up crashing out on the 12th of April just as a result of a cock-up and MPs not taking the action that they need to prevent us from crashing out. And I think that would be really disastrous for the country. So it feels quite scary as well.
That was Sonia Soda. My thanks to her and Peter Beaumont. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys, India Rackerson and Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.